Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to bring the March 4th. Oh, yes, it's March 4th, Star Trek Day, meeting of the Education 5. We're going to try to move on from that. Oh, that's May 4th, isn't it? Ah!
May 4th.
Ooh, Cheryl.
Yep.
Good thing we're not in. We're going to start over. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the March 4th meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. Representative Hewitt, you were here early in your seat. I appreciate that, and I trust you spent time with the minutes. Would you like to move the minutes, sir?
Mr. Chair, I would.
Thank you very much. With that, any discussion to the Hewitt motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. This morning we have a report released by the Office of Legislative Auditor on the compensatory education revenue. We will begin with that, and then we have two bills on the calendar after that. But I'd like to start with the report release. So Ms. Randall, Ms. Hauer, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony and presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Is that working?
I think so.
Okay. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division, and we are pleased to be here today to release our evaluation on compensatory education revenue. So thanks very much for having us. As you know, compensatory education revenue provides funding to school districts and charter schools to help students who are underprepared for or underperforming in schools. Funding is allocated to schools based on the number and concentration of low-income children as defined by eligibility for free or reduced price lunch. In fiscal year 2018, the state allocated to schools more than $550 million in compensatory education revenue. $550 million, it's a lot of money. And understandably, the state wants to know whether that money is having an impact. Is it helping to improve student performance? Well, what you're going to hear, before I get to what you're going to hear, the legislature requires schools to report on the extent to which the funding is improving student performance. But what you're going to hear from us today, from Ms. Hauer, is that expecting school districts to report on that impact, the impact of this one funding stream isolated out of all the things that happen in a school, is unrealistic. Simply put, the data are not available to isolate the impact of compensatory education revenue program alone. As a result, we're recommending that the legislature eliminate this reporting requirement. Now, we're the legislative auditor's office. We're all about accountability, so it's kind of unusual to hear us recommend eliminating a reporting requirement. But we think there is a better and more meaningful way to get accountability on how schools use these funds. And so to hear more about that and to hear more about the other findings and recommendations we have in this report, I'd like to now turn to the manager of this evaluation, Ms. Hauer, for more comments. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Ms. Hauer, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Before I begin, let me please call your attention to my two teammates behind me, Ryan Moltz on my left and Don Hirasuna on my right. They were instrumental in helping me work on this evaluation. What I'm going to start with is a list of the findings that occurred as a result of our evaluation, and then I'll get into some more details on compensatory education revenue itself. So the first of six findings is that the data from the Minnesota Department of Education provide little detail on how schools are actually spending compensatory education revenue. The second is that the statewide effects of compensatory education are simply not known. Third, although the statutes do require school districts to determine whether compensatory education revenue increased student achievement, something that Ms. Randall already referred to, this requirement is unrealistic. Fourth, the calculation of the revenue relies on counts of low-income students from the prior year, and these counts are neither accurate nor timely. Fifth, the statutory requirement that school districts reserve an increasing percentage of their compensatory revenue for extended time activities like summer school or after-school programs is not the best use of the revenue for all districts. And then finally, the requirement that school districts reallocate up to half of their compensatory revenue according to a plan adopted by the school board is an unclear requirement. Let's start with some basic information on compensatory education revenue. Obviously, it's a state funding source. It goes to virtually all school districts around the state and all charter schools. It's intended to help pay for the educational needs of those students who are underprepared to learn or don't meet performance standards that are appropriate for their age group. The revenue amounts will depend largely on the number of students who are low income and the concentration of those students within any given school building. So the more low-income students there are and the more concentrated that they are in a single school site, the more revenue is generated up to a cap. For this program, low income is defined as those students who qualify for either the free lunch program or the reduced price lunch program. And in fiscal year 2018, more than 329,000 students in the state did qualify for either free or reduced price lunch, and this represented about 38% of all students in the state. Again, Ms. Randall already referred to the fact that compensatory education revenue in fiscal year 18 generated over $551 million. This is the second largest component of the general education revenue formula. So where in the state did this revenue go? Well, most of the revenue, 63% of it, went to school districts in the 7-county metropolitan area, and the remaining 37% went to the other 80 counties. Now, I mentioned that virtually all school districts and charter schools do receive compensatory education revenue. However, the students who generate the revenue are located all around the state. In fact, a larger percentage of the rural school districts, as compared with the metropolitan area school districts, had enrollments with very high proportions of low-income students. So on this particular slide, let me call your attention to the bottom two sections. You'll see that if you look at the right-hand column, that represents the school districts outside the metro area. 89% of those had enrollments where low-income students made up at least a quarter of the population and up to 91% of the population. And in contrast, in the metro area, so the left-hand column, 48% of the school districts there had student enrollment with high proportions of low-income students. The statutes allow 12 uses for school districts in terms of how they can use that compensatory education revenue. The uses are very broad. They permit schools to spend the revenue on a really wide variety of educational purposes. I'm going to list just a few of them here. One of those is remedial instruction in reading and other subject areas, lower teacher to student ratios in the classroom so that there can be additional focus on individualized learning, instructional technology, early childhood programs, even counseling and social work services are among those 12 allowed uses. Very little data exists, though, on how much school district spending corresponds with those 12 allowed uses. Data are available for three of the 12, and the three are listed here on the screen. They are the English learner programs. This reserved amount of extended amount that's reserved for extended time programs exclusively, and assurance of mastery programs. But these uses account for just 20% of the compensatory revenue from fiscal year 2018, and for the remaining 80% of the revenue, data are not collected on how the dollars are spent relative to the 12 allowed uses, or the remaining nine of the allowed uses. Well, we think it's important to have additional transparency over the use of the compensatory education revenue. The good news here is that this is expected to change in the coming year. The Minnesota Department of Education just last year had convened a working group to look at this very topic. And in December of 2019, the department approved what will be new reporting codes that the districts will have to comply with for their spending of the compensatory education revenue. We believe that the codes are going to give the kind of detail that has been lacking and will increase the transparency that you as policymakers and other members of the public seek. We do recommend that the department monitor how well these changes make. They will be in place for the first time in the school year beginning 2020, going through 2021. We believe that the department should monitor how well that goes, determine whether they are capturing the level of detail that's necessary, and make whatever adjustments might be necessary to ensure that school districts are consistently reporting on these new codes. We think this is a good step, but we don't think that the reporting codes alone are going to be sufficient to help us understand to what extent the revenue actually makes a difference for students. I do want to mention before I go on talking about the effects of compensatory revenue that it's important to understand that the calculation of the revenue makes a presumption that the students who do qualify for free or reduced price lunch aren't performing as well academically as other students, and that they're going to need some additional help if they're going to be able to perform. So based on an analysis we did in our evaluation, we looked at students who had taken the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments over a period of several years, and we looked for a correlation between income and academic performance, and we found one. This graph shows the results from our analysis for the 2018 year, and you can see in that first set of columns, which is labeled math, those are the math assessments, it shows that about 38% of the students who did qualify for free or reduced lunch, as compared with 13% of other students who did not, they did not meet the state standards in math for fiscal year 2018. Now, at the same time, this correlation, while it's statistically significant, it doesn't hold in all cases. A majority of the students who qualified for free or reduced lunch either met or exceeded the MCAs. So those are, if you were to extend those columns up, you would see above that 38%, the remaining accounts for those students who were low income but did meet the standards. So we know there are students who are not low income and they're not meeting the standards. And those are actually represented by the gray, shorter columns in each of the three sets of columns on this particular slide. Still, the point is that there is a significant correlation between income status and test performance. Now, if I could move on to talking about the effects of compensatory revenue, we found that, first of all, the state doesn't analyze the statewide effects of compensatory education revenue. Statutes do require that the school districts annually report what their spending is in terms of how it has increased student achievement. We conducted a survey as part of our analysis, and about one-third of the districts had reported in our survey that they either do not make this annual report or they're not sure whether the district is making that annual report. So let's talk about the other two-thirds of the districts. Most of the other school districts who said that they do try to analyze the impact of the revenue do it by looking at analyzing the standardized test results, most often the MCAs. The problem with this, though, which is something that, again, Ms. Randall had referred to in her opening remarks, the test results are not able to isolate the impact of compensatory revenue by itself. Think of all the multiple funding sources that come into a school district's general fund. There are many. And it's very difficult to determine whether the test results could be tied to only one piece of this multi-sources of revenue coming into the school district. A second problem with it is that if a study were to be conducted that would try to understand what is the impact isolated to the compensatory revenue fund stream, that is, it would require extremely rigorous research methods. This means things like setting up control groups, some of which would have students who were low income but did not receive services funded by compensatory revenue, in comparison with a group of students, also low income students, who did receive services paid for by compensatory revenue. That, of course, raises many ethical questions that I think no district would want to have to confront. It also means that this rigorous research also means having to understand what are all other and be able to control for all other impacts, other programs, other initiatives going on in the school district that might account for the students' test results. So this kind of rigorous research would require a lot of time, a lot of analytical skills, and a lot of money, things that school districts, many of them aren't going to be set up to do. So due to the difficulties of measuring the impacts of this single revenue stream, we concluded that the requirement to report annually on its impact is really an unrealistic one. We think there is an alternative that will provide some accountability for use of the compensatory revenue. So we first recommend that the legislature would repeal the requirement that currently requires districts to report annually. This is the requirement we think is unrealistic. And then further, we recommend that the legislature require the districts to report instead whether the programs that they fund with substantial amounts of the compensatory education revenue are consistent with best practices that research has demonstrated can help students that are academically behind. We conducted a literature review as a part of our analysis this past year, and we identified several programs that researchers have confirmed over the years that can help struggling students if the programs are structured appropriately, and that's a big caveat, but it is an important one, and an important one. I'm going to give you one example. One of the programs that research has identified as helpful in helping the struggling students is summer school, and that's something that many people are familiar with. Research has shown that summer school can help students who aren't meeting academic standards, but those programs have to have certain attributes. For instance, they should be at least 6 to 8 weeks in duration. A four-week program isn't going to suffice. The summer curricula should be aligned with the curricula that's in place in that district through the regular school year. Parent or guardian involvement is important. And the kids actually have to attend the program. A lot of the research identified programs that weren't working well because for one reason or another, the kids didn't show up for the summer school programs. So it's important that the programs build into their structure some incentives to ensure that the kids are there, and then it's incumbent upon the school district to monitor that and make sure that there isn't high absenteeism. I'm going to switch gears here a little bit now and talk about some of the issues related to using income as the metric for determining whether the students qualify to generate the revenue. So right now, school districts have to collect every year income forms from the families to verify whether the income meets the standard that would make the student eligible for free or reduced price lunch. And it also, of course, is a standard that determines whether the student is going to be generating the compensatory revenue. The problem with these forms is that not all families submit them. And in talking to districts around the state, we found that the superintendents and business managers in these school districts think that there's an increasing percentage of families who are reluctant to submit these forms. This can be due to a variety of reasons, chief among them simply the stigma of having to formally admit and attest to the fact that my family is low income. What this results in is an undercount of the students who would be generating the compensatory revenue in the districts. We did a survey, as I said, and in that survey, we asked superintendents about this particular issue. 3/4 of them reported that they believe that their count of low-income students represents an undercount for their district. There are some alternatives already in place for the income forms because this problem is not a new one. One of those alternatives is called direct certification, and this refers to identifying students that are already enrolled in some of the federal income-based programs, things like SNAP or the Head Start programs. And those children their families will not have to provide a second income form. Information from the Department of Human Services gets transferred over to the Department of Education, and then the Department of Education identifies those students via their student numbers that gets sent out to the districts. So the districts are aware of which of their students are already enrolled in these federal assistance programs, and they don't have to get the income form from them. And that's a good thing. The districts think it's working well, but it is limited. It's limited just to those families that are enrolled in the federal assistance programs. There are some other options that school districts can use to, if what they're looking for is getting free meals for their students, but the trade-off with these other options is that without the signed income forms, they don't have the proof that they need, and they won't receive the compensatory revenue from the state. So we recommend that the Department of Education examine some alternatives that might address some of these issues related to the income forms. And we list some possibilities in our report. One of the things we think should be considered is some factors other than income. Things like looking at a high absentee rates for certain students, or looking at those students who are at risk of not progressing on to the next grade level. We think such students could be considered as generating, or as eligible to generate compensatory education revenue if, in their case, no income form is available. Now, the formula for calculating compensatory revenue requires using the prior year count of students in terms of coming up with the amount of revenue that's going to go to a particular district. So I'd like to, if you permit me, to run through just a brief timeline as an example here. So the number of students that, for instance, last October 1, 2019, were counted, and the number of students counted at that point in October of last fall will be used to calculate the revenue for the 2020 to 2021 school year, so the new year that will start this coming fall. There are two problems with this. The first is that if a school district experiences an influx of a large number of students that are low income, those new students to the school district will not be counted as a part of the count that will be generating the revenue. And of course, the district still has the responsibility to educate those students, but they have to do it without the aid of the compensatory revenue that would be helpful to them. The second problem has to do with the count occurring on October 1 of each year. And because it's done on October 1, a student who enrolls October 2 or any day after that is not counted for the compensatory revenue. If a student enrolls after October 1, then that student will be counted the following year. So it would be somebody who enrolled on October 2nd of 2019 really won't be counted until this coming October. And that amount of that certain individual who enrolled after October 1st wouldn't be part of the generation of revenue for another school year, the year that starts 2021 to 2022. So we recommend that the legislature consider some changes to ameliorate some of the downsides of calculating the revenue based on the prior year counts. I mean, one of the options would be to add a supplemental count, something that's more current and that can account for some of those school districts that have an influx of new students, for example. I mean, another option would be to adjust the count of students based on like the most recent 3 years in terms of enrollment. If enrollment trends over the last 3 years indicated an increasing percentage of students from low-income families, then those districts where that enrollment growth has occurred and where it's projected to continue would see an adjustment in the amount of their compensatory revenue in order to account for some of that expected growth. I'm next going to move to the two requirements in state law related to compensatory education revenue that we thought were important to bring to your attention. So the first is a 2017 law that requires the school districts to reserve an increasing percentage of their compensatory revenue and use it specifically and only for extended time programs. Again, the summer school programs, after school programs, and the like. One problem for some school districts is the amount that's reserved now is just too small to fund a new program. We looked at what was set aside for fiscal year 2018, and the median was $1,300 per school district. Of course, it would be very difficult to start a summer school program anywhere with $1,300. So we can understand why some school districts thought it was not very helpful to them. Some of the other districts that we visited said that the requirement forces them to spend money on some uses that they really don't think work well in their districts, For instance, some of the superintendents from some rural districts we visited said that it was tough for them to get kids to stay after school. And it would mean adding another bus run to get those kids back home after the after-school program ended for the day. In one of the metro area districts we talked with, where summer school, or excuse me, after school already was in place, they had difficulty hiring teachers who were willing to spend that extra time, even though the program was in place already. Finding new teachers to help them out was a real difficulty. And then finally, there was a group of school districts who said that they already fund their extended time programs using other revenue sources, such as targeted services funding. Mm-hmm. And having them then reserve an amount from their compensatory revenue forces them to carve out an amount of what they consider to be a very precious source of money. And they would rather be able to use that compensatory revenue on uses that to them would be more beneficial. So, and then the final point I'll make related to this is part of, again, a result from our survey. We asked school superintendents whether having a percentage of the compensatory revenue dedicated to extended time activities was, in their opinion, the best use of revenue for their district. And as you can see in the slide, if you look at the two orange-colored segments of the slide, of the graph, that nearly 60% of the superintendents stated that they disagreed or strongly disagreed that this was the best use of revenue for their particular district. So we recommend that the legislature repeal this requirement. Repealing it would essentially return the matter to how it existed pre-2017. That is, the 12 allowed uses would remain in place. School districts would have the option to spend that revenue on extended time programs if that met their needs. But it would be up to them to decide on which of these 12 allowed uses the spending should occur. The second requirement and final point that I'll make has to do with how school districts allocate their compensatory revenue once they receive it. As you know, by law, the revenue is required to go to the school buildings where the students who qualify for free or reduced lunch are and where they receive their services. However, the law does authorize school districts to reallocate up to half, 50% of their compensatory revenue according to a plan adopted by the school board. According to the survey I mentioned, we learned that not many school districts are reallocating revenue in this way. However, about 30 indicated that they did. And of those, most of them, 70%, said that they did not have a school board approved plan set out specifically for determining where the reallocation would occur. We asked school districts about this, why not have a school board plan, a school board adopted plan, and they justified the reallocation saying that the school board, of course, does approve the overall budget for the district, and they felt that that was enough to satisfy the requirement that's in statute for the board adopted plan. The statutes, in our opinion, are unclear on this matter. They don't provide guidance on what the plan should include. They don't determine the form that the plan should take. And we think that a clarification of the requirement would be helpful. So we recommend that the legislature do change that law and clarify the board what the board adopted plan really means. We think it could go in one of two ways. One, the legislature could accept really the current level of accountability that's out there and specify that school board approval is sufficient, the school board approval of the overall budget, that is sufficient to also cover this area, that is the reallocation of the compensatory revenue. The second option would be that the legislature decides that more oversight is necessary. In that case, the change would mean specifying what these plans should contain and specifying whether each board should have a specific plan that's set up only for the purpose of reallocating the compensatory revenue. This would also determine whether the department should play a role in monitoring whether these plans are in compliance with the new requirement, if a new requirement is adopted. So with that, Mr. Chair, I've completed my summary, and I would be glad to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Howard. I appreciate that. Questions from members? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Randall and Ms. Howard, for the comprehensive review. Though I have to say it's kind of discouraging. As I understand, $550 million was allocated by the legislature for compensatory education. We aren't sure how that money was used. We aren't sure what impact it had. We don't have any direction from schools, school districts, or the Department of Education, I guess, and how to effectively improve that. And 70% of the school boards around the state haven't assumed the responsibility of having broad discussions and directing the use of that money. Now, that if I misunderstood that, please correct me. But that's what it sounded like as you talked and as I read through the materials. Does that sound correct?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative, basically, yes, I would only suggest that the 70% you refer to refers only to those small number of school districts, about 30, who actually reallocate the revenue once they get it. And what we found is that about 70% of them do not have the school board adopted plan.
Great.
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair, thanks very much. And it gives us plenty to think about and talk about. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair. Mr.
I'm sorry. Oh, pardon, Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, if I could just quickly comment
please.
On Representative Sandell's comment. Well, I think you did accurately sum up what we presented. I just wanted to note that we do present an option to increase the accountability. So while the school districts and the department haven't necessarily, I think if we can get school districts to identify how they're complying with best practices and kind of have a more robust discussion from the department about best practices for that money, and then have school districts demonstrate that they're using it, you know, in accordance with that, I do think we'll have some better accountability on how that money's being used.
Great. Thank you.
Ms. Randall, or yes, Ms. Randall or Ms. Howard, just a clarifying piece. Is the reporting issue that school districts are not complying with the requirement to report, or is it that the state has not provided the tools that allow them to report in a focused enough fashion for us to be able to assess? Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair. It's the latter. It's not a matter of school districts not complying with what's required of them. They are complying by reporting through the Department of Education's UFARS system how they are spending the money. The thing is that the reporting codes used to date have not been specific enough to allow us to know how much of that revenue went to the 12 allowed uses. So the change that I mentioned in my remarks, the change that will be implemented for the next school year, will provide that additional shining the light and transparency on how the money is actually spent.
All right. Thank you for that. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hauer and your staff for a great deal of research to give us this very enlightening report. Really appreciate that. I have a question, though. Did you look at the history of our compensatory law? I believe we first enacted it in 1987. Did you look at the changes that occurred over that period of time through the last change in 2017?
Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, we did. I'm not sure if you want me to go on.
Please.
Okay.
Mr.
Well,
Chair.
Of course.
What we saw in terms of changes were, for the most part, things that would enlarge the body of the 12 allowed uses, permit additional spending in particular areas. I'm not sure if that answers your question fully.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and I think I could do a deeper dive because I was looking at the history and we made a lot of changes over the years. Second question is, did you look at test scores for those districts who received the highest percentage of compensatory into their general revenue?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, well, we looked at the test scores for all students, regardless of what district they were in. We did not look specifically at a particular type of district or anything along the lines of what you are suggesting. We were looking at all students who happened to take the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments over a period of 8 years.
Thank you.
Representative
Erickson.
Mr.
Chair. I'll do some research on my own.
All right. Thank you. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a question for Mr. Strom, perhaps. Sorry, Mr. Strom. I'm wondering, when school districts use compensatory funds for summer school programs, extended time programs, well, first of all, I'm wondering, are they using it for those reasons? It sounds like the answer is yes. But when they're using it, is there any statutory requirement saying that a student has to receive credit or some component of fulfilling a requirement?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanstee, the auditor may want to address this issue as well. There, I think two parts to the initial answer and then a comment if that's all right. So with the extended time revenue reserve, that portion has to be spent according to the criteria for extended time revenue otherwise, which means it's spent for the list of Alternative Learning Center, ALC, and Alternative Learning Program, ALP programs. So for the reserve on that, those have to be spent through essentially the ALC style of programming. For the district itself, extended time that's not part of that reserve could be done in any way. So there are two different ways that the summer school and extended time could be funded, either through the required reserve or through broader programs that affect those. In terms of those programs, and again, the auditor may want to speak to this as well, but in terms of those programs, they don't necessarily need to be for credit. They may be a credit recovery program. They may be a program that's designed for some other purpose to help in a particular skill, but they wouldn't necessarily be credit related.
Representative Sanspeed?
Follow up, thank you. Then I'm wondering, compensatory revenue is supposed to go to a school site, correct?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, and now with many school districts looking at collaborating and you know having collaborative efforts, if they were to access compensatory funds, how would that look when students from maybe multiple districts are going to one school site? Would it follow them, or is it just, would compensatory revenue only be allowed for students that are from that district on that site?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanstee, the auditor may want to comment on this as well, but essentially there is the option for the 50% to be reallocated. So presumably a group of districts working together could reallocate that money to a combined summer school program. There's not a requirement that the money serve only those students who have qualified for free and reduced lunch. So that's not the issue. But the auditor's done some work on this 50% set aside, and they may have some comments on that.
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know that I could add more than what Tim Strom already has. We did find, as I already said, that for the bulk of the school districts, they're not reallocating the money. It's really focused on a smaller number of districts. We found about 30. There may be some more because there may be some that didn't respond to the survey. But it's only among that small group where the reallocation is going to some place other than where the students were who generated the revenue.
Representative Sanstead? More to ponder?
No, just one quick follow-up and then I'm done. In a situation with the 50% reallocation, this is where we're getting into needing a school board approved plan or some, okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who to direct this question to, so I'm gonna throw it out. It might be Mr. Strom, might be our auditor people here. I'm just wondering, are there other broader ways to determine, well, first of all, we know that income is pretty directly connected to achievement for education. Are there other ways outside of a school district to determine the income level? How do I say this? Instead of, right now it's students enrolled and you have to identify what income they are and then compensatory revenue will follow that. But is there a way to, do counties keep track of income level of their people? Could it be done outside of the school district, I guess is my question. Anybody have thoughts?
Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, conceivably, yes. Part of what we recommend is that the department evaluate some of the other possible options, and we list six. I call your attention to page 27 in our report. There's a quick call-out box that gives you just a brief overview, and then we provide more detail in the text. So there are things like, well, let's look at what data are available on low-income families by county using the American Community Survey, which is part of federal collected data. Another possibility would be to base the information on data that could be gleaned from income tax statements. Again, none of these is a simple solution. It would require quite a bit of thought development, but there are some other options that are out there. We also talk about doing some things that I already mentioned, which is kind of shifting away from income as the only metric and looking at, for those kids where an income form is not available, looking at other factors that are indications of students who aren't performing at the level expected for their age group. Things like chronic absenteeism, not progressing from 7th to 8th grade, at risk of not graduating, those kinds of things.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I think that's interesting. I think we need to somehow, and I know it's very complicated, and I can tell from your report how this all works, but when we figure out an appropriate way to identify struggling students and then the compensatory funds that should be to go there, I would love to see our school districts, the school boards, the teachers empowered with more of a block grant style, that money goes to them and let them determine how they can best help their students. And then we hold them accountable through outcomes. Of course, there's got to be accountability. But I'm just throwing that out. I think we need to think outside the box, figure out a way to identify struggling students and the monies that should go towards that, and then empower our schools to work with students. So just throwing that out. Thank you.
Representative Bennett, you might like Representative Cagle's bill here in a few minutes then. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to thank the auditors for spending so much time with me when you were doing the scoping. We talked on the phone for a few hours on some of the issues that you may run into looking at just the MCAs or having to find some other metric like the chronic absenteeism. So I'm really glad that you looked at that. And I had one quick question and then a few comments, but the 89% in rural Minnesota versus 40% on the quarter of kids in the school, can some of that be attributed to, like when I was up in Ely this last summer and I visited the campus up there, it's a high school, elementary school, and a middle school all in one. And then you have like Hopkins that has six elementary schools, two junior highs, and then a high school. So your kids are more distributed. Could that be part of the factor?
Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just because of the population being in the metropolitan area, so much larger than outside of the metropolitan area, that's why a lot of the revenue, what did I say, some 60-some percent of it actually stays within the school districts in the metropolitan area. But in terms of the concentration of students, it's just that there are low-income students all around the state. Mm-hmm. And there, if you're in a smaller district that has a small enrollment, even if you have a small number, that small number of kids might represent a fairly large percentage of the overall enrollment. And so I think that's what accounts for the fact that we saw 89% of the school districts outside of the metro area having fairly large concentrations of low-income students.
Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's what I kind of thought, because fairly high concentration, and because there's only one building to disperse them between two. But I completely agree with you that we have income inequality all over our state. So, and then I wanted to appreciate you for looking more closely at how we can make the plans more transparent. I was a little surprised that only 70% of the districts actually have a plan, and they just assumed okaying the district budget makes that so. I know I've heard some frustrations from a lot of different staff in different areas that, you know, wrongfully or rightfully so, that they get frustrated when they see the need in their school and they're the ones generating the income, yet they feel like they're not getting their fair share. So I'm glad you kind of looked at that. I'm not quite sure how we can fix it, but I would like to see some more transparency around that. And then I also appreciate you finding how difficult it is to kind of isolate just this and the results, because districts have gotten very good at trying to braid what little funding streams they have together to help kids where they're at. So you'll have a student, for example, maybe an ELL student that's getting ELL services, but they're also getting pull out for reading and they're getting pull out for math, and they're also doing extended time, and it's so hard to quantify what's working because they're probably all working. But that is the real crux of trying to kind of dig into these numbers, is because districts out of desperation have become very good at grading all the funding streams together. So I just wanted to thank you for your work, and gave us a lot to think about.
Ms. Hauer, Representative Youakim and I think may be focused on some of the same data in your report, and I'm but trying to understand it differently. I'm looking at slides 5 and 6 that goes to comparing districts in the metropolitan area versus districts in the non-metropolitan area. And the question that this data provokes in my head is, do those graphs show us the concentration of poverty in the metropolitan area versus a broader distribution of poverty in the non-metropolitan area?
Mr. Chair, I think what this shows is that there are a lot of small school districts in the rural part of the state. And for a district that has a small enrollment, relatively speaking, you know, even, you know, 15 students who are low income could represent a you know, a nice high percentage of that in total enrollment. I think that we see 48% on the metropolitan side, because there are some school districts in the metropolitan area where there are relatively few low-income students. And so that contributes to the fact that the metropolitan area column of that graph showed only, I mean, less than half, 48% of the school districts that had significant proportions of low-income students in their student enrollment. It's not that they had none, but it's that it just didn't go over what we just, you know, artificially chose 25% as the first cut to say, to see how many school districts have at least a quarter of their student enrollment as low-income students. So I think it's just that this represents districts, school districts, and these two columns. And so there, you know, there's a preponderance of small school districts in the state. And most of those small districts are in outside of the seven-county metropolitan area, where even a small number of students who are low income would contribute to the percentage that we report here.
All right. Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just also wanted to point your attention to our appendix, which starts on page 70. If you really want to kind of get into all the details, that's every district listed with the number of students qualifying for free or reduced price lunch and what percentage that is. So, I mean, that's probably not for right now, but just for later if you want to kind of really dig into it at a district level.
Thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I heard several times during the testimony of alternate uses or formulas in determining compensatory revenue, and one of them being attendance. And I just want to caution that there's no question that certain circumstances might cause a greater attendance issues, but that we do that very carefully so that we don't end up with unintended consequences of ineffectively rewarding inattendance. So that's something that I heard it several times and it just caught my attention. I wanted to bring that up.
Thank you. Representative Pryor. And we'll be moving towards wrapping up here, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the slides we were looking at before, I did want to follow up on that. So when I look at the metropolitan area and the non-metropolitan area, what I'm a little bit I'm seeing is that the metropolitan area is more segregated in terms of income levels, that you have more of the, that you don't have as many of those, that mid-range. And it may have been arbitrary where you pick the lines, but that you, there are a lot of poor schools in the schools that have that high higher levels of free and reduced lunch, and that there's a lot of those schools. That there's a lot of those schools that don't have it. It's the opposite way, sorry. And so that you see that in the metro area, there's a lot of school districts that are, you know, just generally at a higher, performing at a higher level. But that across the state, that in the non-metro area, that in a community, you know, there's just more of a mix of income levels. And in the metropolitan area, and I think we're aware of this on a lot of different levels, we have areas that are affluent and then areas that are not affluent is what it looks like in the metropolitan areas. So it's kind of like just the history of development in the metro area, which is something I think that we need to be aware of, and that's my district is one of the districts that I represent is part of that too, so I get it. So just it is this these slides really, and especially how we fall out in the metro area is just very, very thought-provoking.
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I agree with you. I think your characterization was correct. I would point out that in the metropolitan area, over 20%, 21% of the school districts had at least half of their student enrollment as kids who were at free or reduced price lunch qualification. So there definitely are some school districts, even in the metropolitan area, with large proportions of low-income children.
Right, there. But then those school districts, a lot of school districts.
Yeah.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just get to my line of questioning very quickly. First of all, Mr. Nobles, Ms. Randall, and the team, thank you very much. Your work is always exemplary. So I want to focus on the graph of correlation between income and achievement. And I like where this is really illuminating some things, and I've seen where it's important to meet the kids where they're at on the achievement gap. One question I have is, and I want to focus on filling out that form. And I don't know if your data or your opinions, but do you think that drives a behavior of just getting more revenue versus getting better outcomes? I see that in the school districts, I mean, I could see their advantage of, hey, let's get these forms filled out because we're going to get more compensatory to revenue. But do you think the superintendents and those that are pushing this really understand with what you said that this could drive results as well?
Ms. Hauer?
It might be a tough one to answer. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kreisha, I'd say that's very difficult to answer. You know, we visited 15 school districts as a part of this evaluation. Most of them were located outside of the metropolitan area. I would not ascribe it, you know, as ulterior motives to any of these superintendents that I interviewed just to hope to get more money. They're hoping to help the kids. They're hoping to be able to fund the programs that they see working to help the kids who are not achieving at the level they should be. So that was my impression from talking with them. There's no way to put that into an analysis. So I think it would be difficult to answer your question with certainty. But I would say based on what I saw and what I heard when I was speaking to school districts, I think their every intention is to help the kids who need the help. And that these kids who typically are struggling, many of them are low income. They'd be the first to tell you that that's not the only segment of students that are struggling, but that for those that do need the extra help, this compensatory education revenue is a vital source of money.
Representative Kreisha?
Follow up. Thank you. And thank you for that. And I never want to suggest there was poor intentions. I'm just trying, there's this, and when I was in the schools, there's this act of filling out the forms that's intriguing to me because, and you mentioned it, and probably just as an offhanded, but why don't these families fill them out? Is it pride? Is it what? My experience suggests that it could be a resilience factor, that something else is happening. We're not filling out this form because other factors at our home. And the reason I bring this up is because when I look at your chart, you mentioned there are kids that are not filling out the forms that are at equal level to those that have filled out the forms, and they're overperforming this other base. My question is why? And I don't know that, you know, but if we can find out that why, there's a reason you didn't fill that form out. You know, and just speculating, is there stuff happening? And you mentioned it with other factors. What's happening at home? What's the stable base? What other things are happening that we can't account for? I know that's out there and wild. Anything you would have an answer to that? Or just agree with me?
Ms. Hauer, two choices there.
Mr. Chair, I choose to agree. No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be flip.
Yeah.
Again, that's a very difficult proposition to think about. I would say yes. I mean, I think the data are clear that there are students who are not considered to be low income, and they are doing poorly on the MCAs. The data are unequivocal about that, so we can say that. And the reverse is true. There are students who are low income and they're doing well on the MCAs. They're performing adequately and in some cases exceeding the standards that the MCAs represent. how you get to trying to help that mm-hmm. segment of students that are really haven't returned the form, which I think is what you're referring to, is something that I think is a quandary for school districts as they put together their plans for how can we best put interventions in place to help those students that need the extra help. Because not everyone who's low income is going to need the extra help. Not everybody who is, is from a wealthier family is going to be doing well. And they could perhaps use the extra help. And there is no restriction, as I think was already said, on whether those dollars are spent exclusively on students who receive or who meet that income threshold. I mean, one clear example is a lot of the districts are using the compensatory revenue to lower the teacher-student class ratio. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, it's not just the students who generated the revenue who are likely to benefit. That benefit will be widespread among all of the class members who get more individual attention from the instructors because there are fewer students in the classroom per adult.
You know, Representative Kreischer, your line of questioning and Ms. Howard's response makes me think of Representative Moran's bill yesterday related to trauma, because obviously divorce does not fall along economic lines. Chemical dependency does not. Involvement with the criminal justice system does, but only to a certain extent and possibly for some extenuating reasons beyond actual incidents mm-hmm. of criminal activities. So there's a number of ACEs that can be spread across the income spectrum and may impact student achievement. Representative yep. Kreischer.
I'll follow up on that as well. And that's why I'm on that bill, by the way. It's a great bill. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that and bringing that as well, because what we're finding, and I know this is probably an impossible test. I mean, let's face it. I think the income, what we're using here was our best effort, but it's flawed. I go back to meeting the kids where they are. There are kids that have lower income levels that don't need the resources that other kids that have higher income levels do need. And until we can meet those kids individually where they're at, we're going to have a tough time with this. So thank you for that. I want to focus that act of filling out the form. For if we can figure that out, why some choose not to fill it out and do well, and why some choose to fill it out and do poorly, we could crack this. My last question is, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for Mr. Strom, because I'm going to let them off the hook. They did such a wonderful job. And Mr. Strom, again, you can agree with me. That would be the easiest solution.
I agree.
No. Why do we I love this committee. Why do we use the October 1st count from the previous year?
Mr. Strom, the ongoing mystery of the October 1st student count.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kreischer, the October count is used for a few purposes. It's called the enrollment count. And the civil rights information systems key off that, as well as a couple of other things. But it's basically a fall count. It turns out well for school lunch for a few reasons, including the federal criteria for when the school lunch count needs to take place. But there's a series of counts that happen that are a one-time count. As you know, most of our measures are mm-hmm. average daily membership that are counted throughout the year. But the enrollment counts are all those fall counts. And part of that ties directly into when the data on demographics is collected, and part of that ties into the lunch data. The process is actually districts have a longer period than just October 1st to turn that data in. They can continue to refine that count, but it is the presence in the school at that point in time that determines that. So there can be modifications to that count as they learn more information about the student status, but the student needs to be enrolled by that date. And for that reason, the department often now refers to it as the fall count instead of the October 1st count.
Representative Kreischer, briefly.
Very, yep, and so thank you for that. And my question to whoever, that's the why. The question is it the best measure? And I would love to, and I can take it offline, but if you got a quick one, what is our best measure?
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kreischer, we aren't going to be getting rid, I don't think Minnesota's going to be getting rid of the count of students mm-hmm. who qualify for free or reduced lunch, because our nutrition right. programs depend on that. It's just that we know there are some families who are reluctant to sign that form for a variety of reasons, and we can talk more about that if you'd like to. And we think that, we need to supplement that count in some way, because there are some kids who are not being counted, and that can be detrimental to them in terms of the revenue available to the district to create, to pay for the interventions that are necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Ms. Hauer, Ms. Randall, thank you very much to your office. We always appreciate the work of the legislative auditor, and you've done a remarkable job here. Thank you for your
thank
work
you.
And your presentation. Representative Cagle. Representative Cagle, I think the OLA may have done your opening and closing remarks for you, but we'll still give you a shot. Representative Sandsteed, would you like to move House File 3316 be before the committee with a recommendation that it be referred to the General Register?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Sandsteed. Representative Cagle, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing 3316. This bill eliminates the requirement that leaks a proportion of the compensatory revenue to extended day programming and allows districts to again use the resources for interventions and support that best meet the needs of their students. As you know, this bill was included in the House Omnibus Education Bill last session. It also has strong support from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, Minnesota School Board Association, Minnesota Association of School Ministers, and Minnesota Rural Education Association. And so with that, I would like to introduce my first testifier, David Law, who's the superintendent of the Anoka-Hennepin School District.
Superintendent Law, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Debney, members of the committee. I'm David Law, superintendent of the Anoka-Hennepin School District. And I'm going to be split personality here for a second. I feel like with all the previous testimony, I want to clarify a couple things. First, as the superintendent of Anoka-Hennepin, I want to drill a little bit on flexibility, and I want to plant a seed for you. We receive about $18 million in compensatory education. Of that, we have about 3,000 English language learner students that we staff at a ratio of 40 to 1 across our system. So that will be high for you on how we support those students, but if those 40 students to 1 or 300 are buried at Blaine High School, that's a school that receives very little comp ed. If we didn't have flexibility, those 300-plus students at Blaine High School wouldn't get EL services because we're $6 million short in our EL funding from the state. So of our $18 million, the first $6 million goes directly to support English language learners. That's the benefit of flexibility. In addition to that, we run large schools. We have two elementary schools, over 1,000 students. All of our middle schools range from 1,200 to 2,000 students. They are unfortunately or fortunately not high poverty. So at a school that has 1,200 students and only 20% of those students are in poverty, which is a fairly low level proportionally, those students don't generate a lot of comp ed and would receive no funding if we didn't have the flexibility to allocate funding to where students have need, which I believe Representative Crusher said, put the resources where we have need. The flexibility you provide allows us to put comp ed money where students in poverty are fortunate or unfortunate to attend a very large school. We run all of our high schools are between 2,000 or just under 2,000 and 3,000, so they don't hit high concentrations, and we benefit from flexibility. That said, the majority of our compensatory education goes in the elementary setting. Earlier, there was a conversation about accountability. I think I counted this as my 12th time speaking on compensatory education in the House or Senate, because we're a district that was part of the pilot. And through my first 4 years as a superintendent, we had to re-up the pilot. And one of the things that I held ourselves to a high standard, we have data to show that it makes a difference. About 3 weeks ago, I testified down here, we are one of the metro leaders in schools that beat the odds. I had three elementary principals that received compensatory education where their schools exceed expected performance in math and reading. You might ask how we use those resources. I can tell you with complete transparency, we do early intervention, K-3. We provide coaching for teachers that are new to the system in reading and math, and we provide additional pull-out instruction for students that are below proficiency. There's no mystery there. And some of our sites where we have high crisis in families and trauma, ACEs, et cetera, we provide some social work support through Comp Ed. That's my Anoka-Hennepin hat. Flexibility allows us to get great results. For 7 years straight, we've had a slow increase in the percentage of students that read. Now representing as the president of Minnesota Association of School Administrators, I'm on the legislative committee for the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we're a C member, which wasn't referenced. all are in support of this. With the recent change in language that forces money outside the school day, what's happening is a school that has 600 students, and of those 600 students, 50% are in poverty. They're getting at an elementary level, they're beating the odds, and they have a very strong reading coach who does intervention. Every year, less of that teacher can be spent in the school day because the additional funds are pushed outside the school day. So next year, that school has to cut that teacher down by 0.2 because the increases that come get pushed to extended day or summer school. Our parents tell us, please teach our children while they're at school during the day. And that's a school that's beating the odds and getting results. And so the principal said, why are we getting less funds? I said, there's a statutory requirement that takes any increases and pushes it outside the school day. My colleagues around the state said, this isn't an expensive fix. Just allow us to use the funds during the school day where they've been effective. And I would be happy to show you the data. Certainly the Star Tribune ran a report. We're one of two metro districts that has the highest percentage of schools that beat the odds. We're at 40% of our schools beat the odds in reading and just under that in math. We're happy with what's working, but what's happening is you're forcing us to take what's working and push it outside the school day in the summer, which is going to be less effective for us. Licensed teachers during the school day are really making a difference for us, along with another piece. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Superintendent Law. Ms. Green. Ms. Green, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Kathy Green, Austin School Board, Chairman Dabney, representatives, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be before you today. I do have a handout, and so if there's a mechanism to... Thank you. Okay. First of all, I'm here in support of the House File 3316. I'm Kathy Green. I've been a school board member in Austin, Minnesota for 20 years. Education policy is my passion. People come to me, they ask me questions, where's it going, what's happening, and any number of things. I'm also the past president of the Minnesota School Boards Association, and currently I am a central region director for the National School Boards Association. And so, looking at this, we are looking at flexibility. I applaud the legislative OLA, their report, what they said in it is valid. It's my experience that I've seen. I also, for David Law before me, I agree with what he has said. Austin, as I handed out, what happens with the ed formula is when it's in legislation, it's very prescriptive. And here in Minnesota, you've got 333 different school districts with 333 different profiles for their students and what their students' needs are. And in this particular bill, the fix helps us because we're a district that, if you look at the handout I handed out, is Austin Public Schools, what we look like. We're over 55% poverty. We are a minority-majority district. If anyone read the Star Tribune article a week and a half ago, it was wonderful. It explained the climate of our district, and we got to that climate by appreciating our students, appreciating their families, and really having a passion for a direction towards learning and student achievement. And with that, we've had the imagination of our staff. We've had innovative programs they brought before us. We have one of our schools is a 4515, an elementary school that would be considered, it's a calendar that they say it's year round, but it's really not. It just has spaces and time where kids don't lose the summer slag. That's one school out of the eight schools we have in our district. And so that was the innovation that teachers saw. And they said, you know what, our kids need in that particular school, it was high refugees in that school, English language learning, if you look at it, we, in close to 36% of our homes, English is not the language spoken at home. And so ESL has been a big thing for us. And so as we're looking at this, Minnesota or Austin also, we're closing our achievement gap. We're having successes. We're having great successes. And one of that was a passion for me is gifted and talented education. And if you all have seen that traditionally gifted and talented education has been white, middle class, upper class, throughout the state, throughout the nation. And through the testing, it's found that all children have the ability to learn at the same capacity and the same numbers, regardless of their demographics. We took that in Austin about 8 years ago and said, okay, what's going on here and how can we attack this? And what we found is that the achievement gap in gifted education, probably in all education we could make correlation, is there was an experience gap. And so how do we bring up the experience gap of all of our children to have the enrichments? And those enrichments happen both inside the classroom and they happen outside the classroom. So you would consider that an extended day. But with us, the money, and through innovation and doing that and opening it to all students, it wasn't just the students of poverty or the students, but it was opening it up. But the kids that really needed the extra experience, they clamored to that. In 6 years at our high school, we have changed it. Our gifted and talented, our AP, our honors class at the high school, reflect the demographics of our district. And so if you look at the paper I handed out before you, those demographics are represented in our gifted and talented program. And I know that we're looking at kids that have particular remediation needs. We haven't left them behind. We have specific programs. And it is the teachers, it's the staff, it's the administration, and it's the school board who have said, we want to teach all kids to their ability. And isn't that what we're all saying with the world's best workforce? And we in Austin have taken that seriously. But going back to the bill before us, that with putting the compensatory dollars and allocating so much to the extended day, that doesn't necessarily mean the dollars are going where they're needed. And when I talked to our business director earlier this week on this particular issue, she said, this is a problem for Austin. And so it's a problem across the state for each district for different reasons. You can't paint it with one brush, but what you can do is fix the bill that we had before us that was passed in 2017.
Thank you, Ms. Green.
Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, do districts have to report, however, salaries out of this pot of money? Do they have to report that as separate items in their UFARs?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the spending of the compensatory money would show up in salary categories, but it might not be attributable to compensatory by salary. So with the way the department does the crosswalking on the UFARS codes, it may just show up as regular instruction. For example, if a district hired a teacher to lower class size, that might just be coded as regular instruction and not have a way to tie back to the compensatory source that it came from.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Strom, for that. Well, we have modified this section of law 23 times since 1987. So I don't know if we want to just go full bore yet, but I think it's pretty soon time to do that, to take a look at a deep dive into compensatory or basic skills revenue, as it's coded under, and do something positive about it so we actually are helping these children. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Austin High School is my graduating high school. My mom was on the school board. and literally, if you get out my Austin High School yearbook, which I still have, and I'll bring it in if you'd like to see it, it's 100% white. 100%. There is not a single student of color when I graduated in whatever year that was. I'm glad that we visited there in the mini session, and I was at Sumner High School, which is the elementary high school, Sumner Elementary School, which was my elementary school. And it's just incredible the work that you've done, and I'm just so proud to be from that community, and I really enjoy going back. And Thank you. Thank you for being here today and telling the story.
We not only visited the Austin School District, we drove past the house Representative Pryor grew up in. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 3316? Seeing none, Representative Cagle, any closing statement?
I just want to thank you all for hearing this bill. This is somewhat personal to me, too. I worked for an organization that did early reading interventions here on the east side of St. Paul for kids in pre-K through third grade. And so we know that early interventions work, and so I just want to make sure that our school districts have the flexibility and the ability to do those early interventions when we can. So I thank you very much for your time and the discussion this morning.
Thank you. With that, Representative Sandsteed renews her motion that House File 3316 be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. You're on your way.
Thank you,
Representative Cagle. Representative Fabian. There you are. Representative Fabian, welcome to the committee. Representative Kreischer, would you like to move House File 3192 be laid over for possible future consideration?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Kreischer. Representative Fabian, welcome. Good morning.
Chair Dabney, thank you, committee, for hearing our bill today, 3192. It's a real simple one. My testifier today is the one who's impacted by this bill. He's the superintendent of schools at Marshall County Central in Newfoundland, Minnesota, a town of about 375 people, which is kind of a typical city in the district that I represent. In essence, what's going on here is, I'm going to let Mr. Lund explain the bill, but it involves a transfer from their early childhood and family education reserve account to their community service fund and their school readiness program. And it's kind of a technical thing, and it's one of those accounting things. And I think through the testimony, you'll understand. And as I've said to you before, Chair Dabney, there might be some other things that you would like to do along these lines for other school districts. But
sure,
we'll have that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Superintendent Lund, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, committee. My name is Jeffrey Lund. I'm superintendent of Marshall County Central Schools in Newfoundland, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am asking for a transfer of funds to move money from our ECFE account to our school readiness account. I know that in the past it had been allowed by the department to allow these transfers. That has since expired. We've used it in the past, but today I had to drive 300 miles and ask you guys to consider this, and I hope that you can. We're very small, and similar to the compensatory bill, flexibility is what we need here, at least in our district. I understand in some bigger districts, ECFE and school readiness, they need their own funding sources. They sometimes compete for resources. In our district, our ECFE program and preschool program are staffed by the same person, and we share equipment, supplies, sometimes staff between both programs. So there is a little more intermingling that is acceptable. And because of accounting and where we draw our revenues from, we often end up with a slight surplus from year to year in ECFE and a slight deficit from year to year in preschool. What we're looking at right now, this is based on last year's funding. We had a $47,585 surplus at the end of the year in ECFE. We had a negative $44,591 in school readiness. And this is a buildup of several years, and we're just asking for this one-time balance transfer to alleviate the issue for now. It may pop up again in the future. We are working with our district auditor, who auditors our funds each year, on ways that we can account a little bit better to not have this come up again. You know, I provided some documents for handouts. In one was just a general fund transfer document that the Department of Ed has. That's what we used to use. We used to ask the commissioner for permission and have her look. We had to have a school board local resolution that showed that the board was aware and that no programming would be hurt by this fund transfer. And then the commissioner could approve it. There was a piece of the 2018 omnibus bill that came out that did allow some fund transferring for community ed, but that bill was overall vetoed by Governor Dayton and it hasn't been readdressed since. So thus the one-time ask for us.
All right. Thank you, Superintendent. Mr. Strom, there's a couple of documents in our members' packets, and I'm wondering if you could just review them briefly for us.
Mr. Chair, members, very briefly, the document that's organized landscape style on the page shows each of the legislatively authorized fund transfers from 1984 to 2019. You can see what account or fund the money came from and where it went, and then the right-hand column shows the statutory reference. For a variety of reasons, in 2012, the legislature created an opportunity for the Commissioner of Education to approve fund transfers. And the other sheet shows those transfers that were authorized from 2012 to 2017. Those were authorized by the department under the broad authority given by the legislature, which allowed basically any fund transfer that did not affect an aid and levy. With a couple of exceptions, there was no transfers allowed out of the lunch fund, and there were also no transfers allowed outside of the community service fund, but transfers within that fund were allowed. As the superintendent pointed out, a number of those transfers were for between ECFE funds and school readiness funds. If you look through that 4 or 5 page list, you'll see that that's probably the single largest transfer that was allowed in, was from ECFE to school readiness.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Questions from members? Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. And just an open conversation, and I don't want to throw any curveballs, but as I was sitting here thinking about, and maybe I'll start with this. Mr. Strom, is there any negative, is there any downside to doing this? I mean, it sounds like a very localized issue. What's our downside? Why wouldn't we do this?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crescia, in the larger scale, I think the legislature is the one that has required reserve accounts for early childhood family education and school readiness aid. Mm-hmm. So the legislature previously has made the decision that those monies that are funded separately should be kept separately. So I think in some ways it's a policy question. Should that apply? Should that apply in all circumstances? Should there be exceptions? And under what conditions should there be those exceptions? I would think the advocates for the ECFE program would argue against transfers into school readiness, and probably vice versa. The school readiness advocates would argue against transfers into the separate ECFE program. But this essentially is a legislative decision because those reserves are required only through legislation into those two separate accounts.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you for that, Mr. Strom. So as I understand it, and Representative Fabian, and to the testifier, you're asking for a consideration for yourself. You've looked at the facts. You've looked at a local issue. You believe this is in the best interest of your situation. You're not asking for broad changes.
No, I would ask.
Superintendent Lund.
I'm sorry. I would concur with Mr. Strom on that. You know, it's flexibility. There are other districts that could benefit from an opportunity like this. But I also see the point of ECFE activists and preschool activists wanting to have funds in their own reserve accounts. But, you know, in this local instance, it really does make sense for us to have a little opportunity here to transfer. And we don't want broad transfer rights. We don't want it forever. I'm hopeful that we can remedy this and not have to continually ask, or that a simpler method can be made for us to do a transfer of funds if possible. This ask today is just one time.
Representative Crescia.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so here's my question to you, and I just want to toss this out. I mean, I don't see, there's no funding impact. My question would be, and I'll throw it out to the committee, why wouldn't we amend the motion to move you to the general register, leave you there? Mr. Chair, you could still include this as possible inclusion for your bill, but give you a couple of avenues based on what happens at the end that you could still move this. I'm just throwing this out there. I'm not, you know, asking for anything, but I thought to myself, my God, you know, let's give you something for driving 300 miles. This is very localized, yeah, one way.
Yeah.
So perhaps the committee would consider that. It's no harm, no foul. It puts it out there, and we can still do everything we're trying to do. I'm just asking.
Sure. Representative Kreisha, Representative Fabian has indicated that Superintendent Lund may be at the head of the parade, and that there may be other districts coming forward with similar requests, at which point the conversation makes more sense to have in one situation. So that's why the motion is what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I was wondering if there wasn't more behind it.
I'm just seeing Superintendent yep. Lund with, you know, the big tall hat and all of that leading the parade, perhaps. I'm not sure. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming all this way to testify for us today. I'm just curious. So I'm the vice chair of the Early Childhood Subdivision, and I sit on the Early Childhood Advisory Council in my home district. So ECFE programming is very close to my heart, and I'm certainly not opposed to this transfer. But I'm curious. I'm hopeful that you could detail a little bit better for us. What are some of the ECFE programs that you offer, and how do we come to this large amount of money that isn't being used toward those type of programs?
Certainly,
Superintendent Lund.
Yes, we do considerable ECFE programming. 2 to 3 times a month, we have an evening night for parents and families to come into our district and visit. We do some field trips, we also do daycare visits where our ECFE person, who happens to be our preschool teacher as well, visits daycares and works with small children. We started that program a few years back. We had a staffing change. Whole other issue, but teacher shortage. Ended up having to staff our ECFE last year under variance with one of our elementary teachers. Well, of course, they were teaching elementary during the day and couldn't go out to do the daycare visits. So we weren't able to do daycare visits last year. That's a portion of this. Sometimes it's a matter of how the income gets derived. You know, ECFE money gets derived via levy from our census. So our draw, sometimes our ability to draw is we have the ability to draw more ECFE funds. We're not a voluntary pre-K school. And because school readiness is drawn differently, we don't draw as many school readiness funds. So it just common sense over time, we do what other schools do too. We put our resources together to make the best thing happen possible. Well, here's the result. We end up with a deficit in one area and a positive in another. It could simply be remedied if there were some transferring allowed, but I totally get the broader perspective and why there could be an uphill battle if this were unilateral. So I want to be respectful of that. I really want the focus to be on this local bill because it's very important to us. I don't want it to get thrown into a broader bill that could have the potential to fail, because then we can't remedy our local issue. But, you know, I don't want to be the leader of the parade, so to speak, but I would support a bill that would allow flexibility because it would benefit our district.
Representative Katiza Routoon, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. So I understand the staffing concern. Have you been able to remedy that now, and are those daycare visits happening again?
Yes, they are.
Wonderful. Thank you.
This is a public hearing. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 3192? Seeing none, Representative Kreisha Representative Fabian, anything more to say?
Oh, thank you.
My apologies.
You know, when you live where I live and a lot of people that live in rural Minnesota, these people work incredibly hard. We talk about staffing and so forth. You have an elementary opening and you don't even get applicants in some cases. So I heard in the previous bill some testimony from the superintendents talking about flexibility. in rural Minnesota, this is an absolutely essential thing to have, and I know that the folks that live out there who serve in this body understand that. So I am here today in total support of what Jeff and his school district are doing. They care deeply about the kids, and they want to serve the kids as best they can. But I do have one other question then to Jeff's point and to Representative Kreisha's point. Is there any way that we can do both? Move this, or what would be the process, Mr. Chair, say 2 weeks from now, a month from now, to be able to take this from consideration in an omnibus bill and move it to the general register? What would be the technical thing that you would have to do at that time?
Representative Fabian, by the committee retaining custody of the bill, we have the option to pick up any of the bills that we're holding over and send them to the general register separately, this one or any other. All right?
I raised that issue just to give some comfort to Superintendent Lund.
Sure. All right. With that, Representative Kreisha renews his motion that House File 3192 be held over for possible inclusion or possible future consideration, as we say these days. And with that, Superintendent, thank you for coming down. Representative Fabian, thank you. We are adjourned.